me to think of what I've said. Do you forgive me for all this? I will forgive you, Agnes, I replied, when you come to do Steerforth justice and to like him as well as I do. Not until then, said Agnes. I saw a passing shadow on her face when I made mention of him, but she returned my smile, and we were again as unreserved in our mutual confidence as of old. And when, Agnes, said I, will you forgive me the other night? When I recall it, said Agnes. She would have dismissed the subject so, but I was too full of it to allow that, and insisted on telling her how it happened that I had disgraced myself, and what chain of accidental circumstances had had the theatre for its final link. It was a great relief to me to do this, and to enlarge on the obligation that I owed to Steerforth for his care of me when I was unable to take care of myself. You must not forget, said Agnes, calmly changing the conversation as soon as I'd concluded, that you were always to tell me not only when you fell into trouble, but when you fell in love. Who has succeeded to Miss Larkins, Trotwood? No one, Agnes. Someone, Trotwood, said Agnes, laughing and holding up her finger. No, Agnes, upon my word. There is a lady, certainly, at Mrs. Steerforth's house, who is very clever and whom I like to talk to, Miss Dartle, but I don't adore her. Agnes laughed again at her own penetration, and told me that if I were faithful to her in my confidence, she thought she should keep a little register of my violent attachments, with the date, duration, and termination of each, like the table of the reigns of the kings and queens in the history of England. Then she asked me if I'd seen Uriah. Uriah Heep, said I. No, is he in London? He comes to the office downstairs every day, returned Agnes. He was in London a week before me. I'm afraid on disagreeable business, Trotwood. On some business that makes you uneasy, Agnes, I see, said I. What can that be? Agnes laid aside her work and replied, folding her hands upon each other and looking pensively at me out of those beautiful soft eyes of hers, I believe he's going to enter into partnership with Papa. What, Uriah? That mean, fawning fellow worm himself into such promotion, I cried indignantly. Have you made no remonstrance about it, Agnes? Consider what a connection it's likely to be. You must speak out. You must not allow your father to take such a mad step. You must prevent it, Agnes, while there's time. Still looking at me, Agnes shook her head while I was speaking, with a faint smile at my warmth, and then replied, "You remember our last conversation about Papa? It wasn't long after that, not more than 2 or 3 days, when he gave me the first intimation of what I tell you. It was sad to see him struggling between his desire to represent it to me as a matter of choice on his part, and his inability to conceal that it was forced upon him. I felt very sorry. Forced upon him, Agnes? Who forces it upon him? Uriah, she replied after a moment's hesitation, has made himself indispensable to Papa. He's subtle and watchful. He's mastered Papa's weaknesses, fostered them, and taken advantage of them until, to say all that I mean in a word, Trotwood, until Papa is afraid of him. There was more that she might have said, more that she knew or that she suspected, I clearly saw. I could not give her pain by asking what it was, for I knew that she withheld it from me to spare her father. It had long been going on to this, I was sensible. Yes, I could not but feel on the least reflection that it had been going on to this for a long time. I remained silent. His ascendancy over Papa, said Agnes, is very great. He professes humility and gratitude. With truth, perhaps, I hope so. But his position is really one of power, and I fear he makes a hard use of his power. I said he was a hound, which at the moment was a great satisfaction to me. At the time I speak of, as the time when Papa spoke to me, pursued Agnes, he had told Papa that he was going away, that he was very sorry and unwilling to leave, but that he had better prospects. Papa was very much depressed then, and more bowed down by care than ever you or I have seen him. But he seemed relieved by this expedient of the partnership, though at the same time he seemed hurt by it and ashamed of it. "But how did you receive it, Agnes?" "I did, Trotwood," she replied, "what I hope was right, feeling sure that it was necessary for Papa's peace that the sacrifice should be made. I entreated him to make it. I said it would lighten the load of his life, I hope it will, and that it would give me increased opportunities of being his companion." "Oh, Trotwood," cried Agnes, putting her hands before her face as her tears started on it, "I almost feel as if I had been Papa's enemy instead of his loving child, for I know how he has altered in his devotion to me. I know how he has narrowed the circle of his sympathies and duties in the concentration of his whole mind upon me. I know what a multitude of things he's shut out for my sake, and how his anxious thoughts of me have shadowed his life and weakened his strength and energy by turning them always upon one idea. If I could ever set this right, if I could ever work out his restoration, as I have so innocently been the cause of his decline." I had never before seen Agnes cry. I'd seen tears in her eyes when I had brought new honours home from school, and I had seen them there when we last spoke about her father, and I had seen her turn her gentle head aside when we took leave of one another, but I had never seen her grieve like this. It made me so sorry that I could only say in a foolish, helpless manner, "Pray, Agnes, don't, my dear sister." But Agnes was too superior to me in character and purpose, as I know well now, whatever I might know or not know then, to be long in need of my entreaties. The beautiful, calm manner which makes her so different in my remembrance from everybody else came back again as if a cloud had passed from a serene sky. "We're not likely to remain alone much longer," said Agnes, "and while I have an opportunity, let me earnestly entreat you, Trotwood, to be friendly to Uriah. Don't repel him. Don't resent, as I think you have a general disposition to do, what may be uncongenial to you in him. He may not deserve it, for we know no certain ill of him. In any case, think first of Papa and me." Agnes had no time to say more, for the room door opened, and Mrs. Waterbrook, who was a large lady, or who wore a large dress, I don't exactly know which, for I don't know which was dress and which was lady, came sailing in. I had a dim recollection of having seen her at the theatre, as if I'd seen her in a pale magic lantern, but she appeared to remember me perfectly, and still to suspect me of being in a state of intoxication. Finding by degrees, however, that I was sober, and I hope that I was a modest young gentleman, Mrs. Waterbrook softened towards me considerably, and inquired firstly if I went much into the parks, and secondly if I went much into society. On my replying to both these questions in the negative, it occurred to me that I fell again in her good opinion, but she concealed the fact gracefully and invited me to dinner next day. I accepted the invitation and took my leave, making a call on Uriah in the office as I went out, and leaving a card for him in his absence. When I went to dinner next day, and on the street door being opened, plunged into a vapour bath of haunch of mutton, I divined that I was not the only guest, for I immediately identified the ticket-porter in disguise assisting the family servant and waiting at the foot of the stairs to carry up my name. He looked to the best of his ability when he asked me for it confidentially, as if he had never seen me before, but well did I know him, and well did he know me. Conscience made cowards of us both. I found Mr. Waterbrook to be a middle-aged gentleman with a short throat and a good deal of shirt-collar, who only wanted a black nose to be the portrait of a pug-dog. He told me he was happy to have the honour of making my acquaintance, and when I paid my homage to Mrs. Waterbrook, presented me with much ceremony to a very awful lady in a black velvet dress and a great black velvet hat, whom I remember as looking like a near relation of Hamlet's, say his aunt. Mrs. Henry Spiker was this lady's name, and her husband was there too, so cold a man that his head, instead of being grey, seemed to be sprinkled with hoar-frost. Immense deference was shown to the Henry Spikers, male and female, which Agnes told me was an account of Mr. Henry Spiker being solicitor to something or to somebody, I forget what or which, remotely connected with the Treasury. I found Uriah Heep among the company in a suit of black, and in deep humility. He told me, when I shook hands with him, that he was proud to be noticed by me, and that he really felt obliged to me for my condescension. I could have wished he'd been less obliged to me, for he hovered about me in his gratitude all the rest of the evening, and whenever I said a word to Agnes, was sure, with his shadowless eyes and cadaverous face, to be looking gauntly down upon us from behind. There were other guests, all iced for the occasion, as it struck me, like the wine. But there was one who attracted my attention before he came in, on account of my hearing him announced as Mr. Traddles. My mind flew back to Salem House, and could it be Tommy, I thought, who used to draw the skeletons? I looked for Mr. Traddles with unusual interest. He was a sober, steady-looking young man of retiring manners, with a comic head of hair and eyes that were rather wide open, and he got into an obscure corner so soon that I had some difficulty in making him out. At length I had a good view of him, and either my vision deceived me or it was the old unfortunate Tommy. I made my way to Mr. Waterbrook and said that I believed I had the pleasure of seeing an old schoolfellow there. "Indeed," said Mr. Waterbrook, surprised. "You're too young to have been at school with Mr. Henry Spiker." "Oh, I don't mean him," I returned. "I mean the gentleman named Traddles." "Oh, aye, aye, indeed," said my host, with much diminished interest. "Possibly." "If it's really the same person," said I, glancing towards him, "it was at a place called Salem House where we were together, and he was an excellent fellow." "Oh, yes. Traddles is a good fellow," returned my host, nodding his head with an air of toleration. "Traddles is quite a good fellow." "It's a curious coincidence," said I. "It is, really," returned my host, "quite a coincidence that Traddles should be here at all." "Yes, Traddles was only invited this morning when the place at table intended to be occupied by Mrs. Henry Spiker's brother became vacant in consequence of his indisposition. A very gentlemanly man, Mrs. Henry Spiker's brother, Mr. Copperfield." I murmured an assent, which was full of feeling, considering that I knew nothing at all about him, and I inquired what Mr. Traddles was by profession. "Traddles," returned Mr. Waterbrook, "is a young man reading for the bar." "Yes, he's quite a good fellow. Nobody's enemy but his own." "Is he his own enemy?" said I, sorry to hear this. "Well," returned Mr. Waterbrook, pursing up his mouth and playing with his watch chain in a comfortable, prosperous sort of way, "I should say he was one of those men who stand in their own light. Yes, I should say he would never, for example, be worth £500. Traddles was recommended to me by a professional friend." "Oh, yes, yes. He has a kind of talent for drawing briefs and stating a case in writing plainly. I'm able to throw something in Traddles' way in the course of the year, something for him considerable." "Oh, yes, yes." I was much impressed by the extremely comfortable and satisfied manner in which Mr. Waterbrook delivered himself of this little word, "yes," every now and then. There was wonderful expression in it. It completely conveyed the idea of a man who had been born, not to say with a silver spoon, but with a scaling ladder, and had gone on mounting all the heights of life, one after another, until now he looked from the top of the fortifications with the eye of a philosopher and a patron on the people down in the trenches. My reflections on this theme were still in progress when dinner was announced. Mr. Waterbrook went down with Hamlet's aunt. Mr. Henry Spiker took Mrs. Waterbrook. Agnes, whom I should have liked to take myself, was given to a simpering fellow with weak legs. Uriah, Traddles and I, as the junior part of the company, went down last, how we could. I was not so vexed at losing Agnes as I might have been, since it gave me an opportunity of making myself known to Traddles on the stairs, who greeted me with great fervour. While Uriah writhed with such obtrusive satisfaction and self-abasement that I could gladly have pitched him over the banisters. Traddles and I were separated at table, being billeted in two remote corners, he in the glare of a red velvet lady, I in the gloom of Hamlet's aunt. The dinner was very long, and the conversation was about the aristocracy and blood. Mrs. Waterbrook repeatedly told us that if she had a weakness, it was blood. It occurred to me several times that we should have got on better if we'd not been quite so genteel. We were so exceedingly genteel that our scope was very limited. Mr. and Mrs. Gulpidge were of the party, who had something to do at second hand, at least Mr. Gulpidge had, with the law business of the bank. And what with the bank and what with the treasury, we were as exclusive as the court circular. To mend the matter, Hamlet's aunt had the family failing of indulging in soliloquy, and held forth in a desultory manner by herself on every topic that was introduced. These were few enough, to be sure, but as we always fell back upon blood, she had as wide a field for abstract speculation as her nephew himself. We might have been a party of ogres, the conversation assumed such a sanguine complexion. I confess I am of Mrs. Waterbrook's opinion, said Mr. Waterbrook, with his wine-glass at his eye. Other things are all very well in their way, but give me blood. Oh, there's nothing, observed Hamlet's aunt, so satisfactory to one. There is nothing that is so much one's beau ideal of all that sort of thing, speaking generally. There are some low minds, not many, I'm happy to believe, but there are some, that would prefer to do what I should call bow down before idols, positively idols, before services, intellect, and so on. But these are intangible points. Blood is not so. We see blood in a nose, and we know it. We meet with it in a chin, and we say, there it is, that's blood. It's an actual matter of fact. We point it out. It admits of no doubt. The simpering fellow with the weak legs, who had taken Agnes down, stated the question more decisively. Yet, I thought, oh, you know, deuce take it, said this gentleman, looking round the board with an imbecile smile. We can't forego blood, you know. We must have blood, you know. Some young fellows, you know, may be a little behind in their station, perhaps in point of education and behaviour, and may go a little wrong, you know, and get themselves and other people into a variety of fixes and all that. But deuce take it, it's delightful to reflect that they've got blood in them. Myself, I'd rather at any time be knocked down by a man who'd got blood in him than I'd be picked up by a man who hadn't. This sentiment, as compressing the general question into a nutshell, gave the utmost satisfaction, and brought the gentleman into great notice until the ladies retired. After that, I observed that Mr. Gulpidge and Mr. Henry Spiker, who had hitherto been very distant, entered into a defensive alliance against us, the common enemy, and exchanged a mysterious dialogue across the table for our defeat and overthrow. That affair of the first bond for £4,500 has not taken the course that was expected, Spiker, said Mr. Gulpidge. Do you mean the D of A's? Said Mr. Spiker. The C of B's, said Mr. Gulpidge. Mr. Spiker raised his eyebrows and looked much concerned. When the question was referred to Lord... I needn't name him, said Mr. Gulpidge, checking himself. I understand, said Mr. Spiker. N. Mr. Gulpidge darkly nodded. Was referred to him, his answer was, money or no release. Lord bless my soul, cried Mr. Spiker. Money or no release, repeated Mr. Gulpidge firmly. The next in reversion, you understand me? K, said Mr. Spiker, with an ominous look. K? Then positively refused to sign. He was attended at Newmarket for that purpose, and he point-blank refused to do it. Mr. Spiker was so interested that he became quite stony. So the matter rests at this hour, said Mr. Gulpidge, throwing himself back in his chair. Our friend Waterbrook will excuse me if I forbear to explain myself generally, but on account of the magnitude of the interests involved. Mr. Waterbrook was only too happy, as it appeared to me, to have such interests and such names even hinted at across his table. He assumed an expression of gloomy intelligence, though I'm persuaded he knew no more about the discussion than I did, and highly approved of the discretion that had been observed. Mr. Spiker, after the receipt of such a confidence, naturally desired to favour his friend with a confidence of his own. Therefore, the foregoing dialogue was succeeded by another in which it was Mr. Gulpidge's turn to be surprised, and that by another in which the surprise came round to Mr. Spiker's turn again, and so on, turn and turn about. All this time we, the outsiders, remained oppressed by the tremendous interests involved in the conversation, and our host regarded us with pride as the victims of a salutary awe and astonishment.
This ends Side 2 of Cassette 12 of David Copperfield. Please fast forward to the end before loading Cassette 13. Copperfield, Cassette 13.
I was very glad indeed to get upstairs to Agnes and to talk with her in a corner and to introduce Traddles to her, who was shy but agreeable, and the same good-natured creature still. As he was obliged to leave early on account of going away next morning for a month, I had not nearly so much conversation with him as I could have wished, but we exchanged addresses and promised ourselves the pleasure of another meeting when he should come back to town. He was greatly interested to hear that I knew Steerforth, and spoke of him with such warmth that I made him tell Agnes what he thought of him. But Agnes only looked at me the while, and very slightly shook her head when only I observed her. As she was not among people with whom I believed she could be very much at home, I was almost glad to hear that she was going away within a few days, though I was sorry at the prospect of parting from her again so soon. This caused me to remain until all the company were gone. Conversing with her and hearing her sing was such a delightful reminder to me of my happy life in the grave old house she had made so beautiful, that I could have remained there half the night. But having no excuse for staying any longer, when the lights of Mr. Waterbrook's society were all snuffed out, I took my leave very much against my inclination. I felt then, more than ever, that she was my better angel. And if I thought of her sweet face and placid smile as though they'd shone on me from some removed being like an angel, I hope I thought no harm. I've said that the company were all gone, but I ought to have accepted Uriah, whom I don't include in that denomination, and who had never ceased to hover near us. He was close behind me when I went downstairs. He was close beside me when I walked away from the house, slowly fitting his long skeleton fingers into the still longer fingers of a great Guy Fawkes pair of gloves. It was in no disposition for Uriah's company, but in remembrance of the entreaty Agnes had made to me, that I asked him if he would come home to my rooms and have some coffee. "Oh, really, Master Copperfield," he rejoined. "I beg your pardon, Mr. Copperfield, but the other comes so natural. I don't like that you should put a constraint upon yourself to ask a numble person like me to your house." "There's no constraint in the case," said I. "Will you come?" "I should like to very much," replied Uriah with a writhe. "Well, then come along," said I. I couldn't help being rather short with him, but he appeared not to mind it. We went the nearest way without conversing much upon the road, and he was so humble in respect to those scarecrow gloves that he was still putting them on and seemed to have made no advance in that labour when we got to my place. I led him up the dark stairs to prevent his knocking his head against anything, and really his damp, cold hand felt so like a frog in mine that I was tempted to drop it and run away. Agnes and hospitality prevailed, however, and I conducted him to my fireside. When I lighted my candles, he fell into meek transports with the room that was revealed to him, and when I heated the coffee in an unassuming block-tin vessel in which Mrs. Crupp delighted to prepare it, chiefly, I believe, because it wasn't intended for the purpose being a shaving pot, and because there was a patent invention of great price mouldering away in the pantry, he professed so much emotion that I could joyfully have scalded him. "Oh! Really, Master Copperfield, Mr. Copperfield," said Uriah, "to see you waiting upon me is what I never could have expected. But one way and another so many things happened to me which I never could have expected, I'm sure, in my humble station, that it seems to rain blessings on my head. You have heard something, I dare say, of a change in my expectations, Master Copperfield. I should say, Mr. Copperfield." As he sat on my sofa with his bony knees drawn up under his coffee cup, his hat and gloves upon the ground close to him, his spoon going softly round and round, his shadowless red eyes, which looked looked as if they'd scorched their lashes off, turned towards me without looking at me. The disagreeable dints I have formerly described in his nostrils coming and going with his breath, and a snaky undulation pervading his frame from his chin to his boots, I decided in my own mind that I disliked him intensely. It made me very uncomfortable to have him for a guest, for I was young then, and unused to disguise what I so strongly felt. You have heard something, I dare say, of a change in my expectations, Master Copperfield. I should say Mr. Copperfield, observed Uriah. Yes, said I, something. Ah, I thought Miss Agnes would know of it. He quietly returned. I'm glad to find Miss Agnes knows of it. Oh, thank you, Master. Mr. Copperfield. I could have thrown my bootjack at him. It lay ready on the rug, for having entrapped me into the disclosure of anything concerning Agnes, however immaterial. But I only drank my coffee. What a prophet you have shown yourself, Mr. Copperfield, pursued Uriah. Dear me, what a prophet you have proved yourself to be. Don't you remember saying to me once that perhaps I should be partner in Mr. Wickfield's business, and perhaps it might be Wickfield and Heap? You may not recollect it, but when a person is humble, Master Copperfield, a person treasures such things up. I recollect talking about it, said I, though I certainly didn't think it very likely then. Oh, but who would have thought it likely, Mr. Copperfield, returned Uriah enthusiastically. I'm sure I didn't myself. I recollect saying with my own lips that I was much too humble, so I considered myself really and truly. He sat with that carved grin on his face, looking at the fire as I looked at him. But the humblest persons, Master Copperfield, he presently resumed, may be the instruments of good. I'm glad to think I have been the instrument of good to Mr. Wickfield, and that I may be more so. Oh, what a worthy man he is, Mr. Copperfield, but how imprudent he has been. I'm sorry to hear it, said I. I couldn't help adding rather pointedly, on all accounts. Decidedly so, Mr. Copperfield, replied Uriah, on all accounts. Miss Agnes's above all. You don't remember your own eloquent expressions, Master Copperfield, but I remember how you said one day that everybody must admire her, and how I thanked you for it. You have forgot that, I've no doubt, Master Copperfield. No, said I dryly. Oh, how glad I am you've not, exclaimed Uriah with rapture. To think that you should be the first to kindle the sparks of ambition in my humble breast, and that you've not forgot it. Ah! Would you excuse my asking for a cup more coffee? Something in the emphasis he laid upon the kindling of those sparks, and something in the glance he directed at me as he said it, had made me start as if I had seen him illuminated by a blaze of light. Recalled by his request, preferred in quite another tone of voice, I did the honours of the shaving-pot. But I did them with an unsteadiness of hand, a sudden sense of being no match for him, and a perplexed, suspicious anxiety as to what he might be going to say next, which I felt couldn't escape his observation. He said nothing at all. He stirred his coffee round and round, he sipped it. He felt his chin softly with his grisly hand. He looked at the fire. He looked about the room. He gasped rather than smiled at me. He writhed and undulated all over in his deferential civility. He stirred and sipped again, but he left the renewal of the conversation to me. So, Mr. Wickfield, said I at last, who is worth 500 of you, or me, for my life I think I couldn't have helped dividing that part of the sentence with an awkward jerk, has been imprudent, has he, Mr. Heap? Oh, very imprudent indeed, Master Copperfield, returned Uriah, sighing modestly. Oh, very much so. But I wish you'd call me Uriah, if you please. It's like old times. Well, Uriah, said I, bolting it out with some difficulty. Thank you, he returned with fervour. Thank you, Master Copperfield. It's like the blowing of old breezes or the ringing of old bells is to hear you say Uriah. I beg your pardon. Was I making any observation? About Mr. Wickfield, I suggested. Oh, yes, truly, said Uriah. Ah, great imprudence, Master Copperfield. It's a topic that I wouldn't touch upon to any soul but you. Even to you, I could only touch upon it and no more. If anyone else had been in my place during the last few years, by this time he would have had Mr. Wickfield, oh, what a worthy man he is, Master Copperfield, too, under his thumb. Under his thumb, said Uriah very slowly, as he stretched out his cruel-looking hand above my table and pressed his own thumb down upon it until it shook and shook the room. If I'd been obliged to look at him with his splay foot on Mr. Wickfield's head, I think I could scarcely have hated him more. Oh, dear, yes, Master Copperfield, he proceeded in a soft voice, most remarkably contrasting with the action of his thumb, which did not diminish its hard pressure in the least degree. There's no doubt of it. There would have been loss, disgrace, I don't know what all. Mr. Wickfield knows it. I am the humble instrument of humbly serving him, and he puts me on an eminence I hardly could have hoped to reach. How thankful should I be! With his face turned towards me as he finished, but without looking at me, he took his crooked thumb off the spot where he'd planted it, and slowly and thoughtfully scraped his lank jaw with it as if he were shaving himself. I recollect well how indignantly my heart beat as I saw his crafty face, with the appropriately red light of the fire upon it, preparing for something else. "Master Copperfield," he began, "but am I keeping you up?" "You are not keeping me up. I generally go to bed late." "Thank you, Master Copperfield. I have risen from my humble station since first you used to address me, it's true, but I am humble still. I hope I never shall be otherwise than humble. You will not think the worse of my humbleness if I make a little confidence to you, Master Copperfield, will you?" "Oh, no," said I, with an effort. "Thank you." He took out his pocket handkerchief and began wiping the palms of his hands. "Miss Agnes, Master Copperfield." "Well, Uriah?" "Oh, how pleasant to be called Uriah spontaneously," he cried, and gave himself a jerk like a convulsive fish. "You thought her looking very beautiful tonight, Master Copperfield?" "I thought her looking as she always does, superior in all respects to everyone around her," I returned. "Oh, thank you. It's so true," he cried. "Oh, thank you very much for that." "Not at all," I said loftily. "There's no reason why you should thank me." "Why, that, Master Copperfield," said Uriah, "is, in fact, a confidence that I'm going to take the liberty of reposing. Humble as I am," he wiped his hands harder and looked at them and at the fire by turns, "humble as my mother is, and lowly as our poor but honest roof has ever been, the image of Miss Agnes, I don't mind trusting you with my secret, Master Copperfield, for I have always overflowed towards you since the first moment I had the pleasure of beholding you in a pony chay, has been in my breast for years. Oh, Master Copperfield, with what a pure affection do I love the ground my Agnes walks on. I believe I had a delirious idea of seizing the red-hot poker out of the fire and running him through with it. It went from me with a shock like a ball fired from a rifle, but the image of Agnes, outraged by so much as a thought of these red-headed animals, remained in my mind when I looked at him, sitting all awry as if his mean soul griped his body and made me giddy. He seemed to swell and grow before my eyes. The room seemed full of the echoes of his voice, and the strange feeling, to which perhaps no one is quite a stranger, that all this had occurred before at some indefinite time, and that I knew what he was going to say next, took possession of me. A timely observation of the sense of power that there was in his face did more to bring back to my remembrance the entreaty of Agnes in its full force than any effort I could have made. I asked him, with a better appearance of composure than I could have thought possible a minute before, whether he had made his feelings known to Agnes. "Oh, "No, Master Copperfield," he returned. "Oh, dear, no. Not to anyone but you. You see, I am only just emerging from my lowly station. I rest a good deal of hope on her observing how useful I am to her father, for I trust to be very useful to him indeed, Master Copperfield, and how I smooth the way for him and keep him straight. She's so much attached to her father, Master Copperfield. Oh, what a lovely thing it is in a daughter, that I think she may come on his account to be kind to me. I fathomed the depth of the rascal's whole scheme and understood why he laid it bare. If you'll have the goodness to keep my secret, Master Copperfield," he pursued, "and not in general to go against me, I shall take it as a particular favour. You wouldn't wish to make unpleasantness. I know what a friendly heart you've got, but having only known me on my humble footing, on my humblest, I should say, for I am very humble still, you might, unbeknown, go against me, rather, with my Agnes. I call her mine, you see, Master Copperfield. There's a song that says I'd crowns resign to call her mine. I hope to do it one of these days. Dear Agnes. So much too loving and too good for anyone that I could think of. Was it possible that she was reserved to be the wife of such a wretch as this? There's no hurry at present, you know, Master Copperfield. Uriah proceeded in his slimy way as I sat gazing at him with this thought in my mind. My Agnes is very young still, and Mother and me will have to work our way upwards and make a good many new arrangements before it would be quite convenient, so I shall have time gradually to make her familiar with my hopes as opportunities offer. Oh, I'm so much obliged to you for this confidence. Oh, it's such a relief, you can't think, to know that you understand our situation and are certain, as you wouldn't wish to make unpleasantness in the family, not to go against me. He took the hand, which I dared not withhold, and having given it a damp squeeze, referred to his pale-faced watch. "Dear me," said, "it's past one. The moments slip away so in the confidence of old times, Master Copperfield, that it's almost half past one." I answered that I thought it was later. Not that I really thought so, but because my conversational powers were effectually scattered. "Dear me," he said, considering. "The house that I'm stopping at, a sort of private hotel and boarding house, Master Copperfield, near the New River Head, will have gone to bed these 2 hours. I'm sorry," I returned, "that there's only one bed here, and that I..." "Oh, don't think of mentioning beds, Master Copperfield," he rejoined ecstatically, drawing up one leg. "But would you have any objections to my laying down before the fire?" "Well, if it comes to that," I said, "pray take my bed and I'll lie down before the fire." His repudiation of this offer was always shrill enough in the excess of its surprise and humility to have penetrated to the ears of Mrs. Crupp, then sleeping, I suppose, in a distant chamber situated at about the level of low watermark, soothed in her slumbers by the ticking of an incorrigible clock, to which she always referred me when we had any little difference on the score of punctuality, and which was never less than 3/4 of an hour too slow, and had always been put right in the morning by the best authorities. As no arguments I could urge in my bewildered condition had the least effect upon his modesty in inducing him to accept my bedroom, I was obliged to make the best arrangements I could for his repose before the fire. The mattress of the sofa, which was a great deal too short for his lank figure, the sofa pillows, a blanket, the table cover, a clean breakfast cloth and a greatcoat, made him a bed and covering for which he was more than thankful. Having lent him a nightcap, which he put on at once, and in which he made such an awful figure that I've never worn one since, I left him to his rest. I never shall forget that night. I never shall forget how I turned and tumbled, how I wearied myself with thinking about Agnes and this creature, how I considered what could I do and what ought I to do, how I could come to no other conclusion than that the best course for her peace was to do nothing, and to keep to myself what I'd heard. If I went to sleep for a few moments, the image of Agnes with her tender eyes, and of her father looking fondly on her, as I had so often seen him look, arose before me with appealing faces and filled me with vague terrors. When I awoke, The recollection that Uriah was lying in the next room sat heavy on me like a waking nightmare, and oppressed me with a leaden dread as if I had had some meaner quality of devil for a lodger. The poker got into my dozing thoughts besides, and wouldn't come out. I thought, between sleeping and waking, that it was still red-hot, and I'd snatched it out of the fire and run him through the body. I was so haunted at last by the idea, though I knew there was nothing in it, that I stole into the next room to look at him. There I saw him, lying on his back with his legs extending to I don't know where, gurglings taking place in his throat, stoppages in his nose, and his mouth open like a post office. He was so much worse in reality than in my distempered fancy that afterwards I was attracted to him in very repulsion, and couldn't help wandering in and out every half hour or so and taking another look at him. Still, the long, long night seemed heavy and hopeless as ever, and no promise of day was in the murky sky. When I saw him going downstairs early in the morning, for thank heaven he wouldn't stay to breakfast, it appeared to me as if the night was going away in his person. When I went out to the Commons, I charged Mrs. Crupp with particular directions to leave the windows open, that my sitting-room might be aired and purged of his presence. Chapter 26. I Fall into Captivity. I saw no more of Uriah Heep until the day when Agnes left town. I was at the coach office to take leave of her and see her go, and there was he, returning to Canterbury by the same conveyance. It was some small satisfaction to me to observe his spare, short-waisted, high-shouldered, mulberry-coloured greatcoat perched up in company with an umbrella like a small tent on the edge of the back seat on the roof, while Agnes was, of course, inside. But what I underwent in my efforts to be friendly with him while Agnes looked on perhaps deserved that little recompense. At the coach window, as at the dinner party, he hovered about us without a moment's intermission, like a great vulture, gorging himself on every syllable that I said to Agnes or Agnes said to me. In the state of trouble into which his disclosure by my fire had thrown me, I'd thought very much of the words Agnes had used in reference to the partnership. I did what I hope was right, feeling sure that it was necessary for Papa's peace that the sacrifice should be made, I entreated him to make it. A miserable foreboding that she would yield to and sustain herself by the same feeling in reference to any sacrifice for his sake had oppressed me ever since. I knew how she loved him. I knew what the devotion of her nature was. I knew from her own lips that she regarded herself as the innocent cause of his errors, and as owing him a great debt she ardently desired to pay. I had no consolation in seeing how different she was from this detestable Rufus with the mulberry-coloured greatcoat, for I felt that in the very difference between them, in the self-denial of her pure soul and the sordid baseness of his, the greatest danger lay. All this, doubtless, he knew thoroughly, and had in his cunning considered well. Yet I was so certain that the prospect of such a sacrifice afar off must destroy the happiness of Agnes, and I was so sure from her manner of its being unseen by her then and having cast no shadow on her yet, that I could as soon have injured her as given her any warning of what impended. Thus it was that we parted without explanation. She, waving her hand and smiling farewell from the coach window, her evil genius writhing on the roof as if he had her in his clutches and triumphed. I couldn't get over this farewell glimpse of them for a long time. When Agnes wrote to tell me of her safe arrival, I was as miserable as when I saw her going away. Whenever I fell into a thoughtful state, this subject was sure to present itself, and all my uneasiness was sure to be redoubled. Hardly a night passed without my dreaming of it. It became a part of my life, and as inseparable from my life as my own head. I had ample leisure to refine upon my uneasiness, for Steerforth was at Oxford, as he wrote to me, and when I was not at the Commons, I was very much alone. I believe I had at this time some lurking distrust of Steerforth. I wrote to him most affectionately in reply to his, but I think I was glad upon the whole that he couldn't come to London just then. I suspect the truth to be that the influence of Agnes was upon me, undisturbed by the sight of him, and that it was the more powerful with me because she had so large a share in my thoughts and interest. In the meantime, days and weeks slipped away. I was articled to Spenlow and Jawkins. I had £90 a year, exclusive of my house rent and sundry collateral matters, from my aunt. My rooms were engaged for 12 months certain, and though I still found them dreary of an evening, and the evenings long, I could settle down into a state of equable low spirits, and resign myself to coffee, which I seem, on looking back, to have taken by the gallon at about this period of my existence. At about this time, too, I made 3 discoveries. First, that Mrs. Crupp was a martyr to a curious disorder called the spasms, which was generally accompanied with inflammation of the nose and required to be constantly treated with peppermint. Secondly, that something peculiar in the temperature of my pantry made the brandy bottles burst. Thirdly, that I was alone in the world and much given to record that circumstance in fragments of English versification. On the day when I was articled, no festivity took place beyond my having sandwiches and sherry into the office for the clerks, and going alone to the theatre at night. I went to see The Stranger, as a doctor's common sort of play, and was so dreadfully cut up that I hardly knew myself in my own glass when I got home. Mr. Spenlow remarked on this occasion, when we concluded our business, that he should have been happy to have seen me at his house at Norwood to celebrate our becoming connected, but for his domestic arrangements being in some disorder on account of the expected return of his daughter from finishing her education at Paris. But he intimated that when she came home he should hope to have the pleasure of entertaining me. I knew that he was a widower with one daughter, and expressed my acknowledgements. Mr. Spenlow was as good as his word. In a week or two he referred to this engagement, and said that if I would do him the favour to come down next Saturday and stay till Monday, he would be extremely happy. Of course, I said I would do him the favour, and he was to drive me down in his phaeton and to bring me back. When the day arrived, my very carpet-bag was an object of veneration to the stipendiary clerks, to whom the house at Norwood was a sacred mystery. One of them informed me that he'd heard that Mr. Spenlow ate entirely off plate and china, and another hinted at champagne being constantly on draught after the usual custom of table beer. The old clerk with the wig, whose name was Mr. Tiffy, had been down on business several times in the course of his career, and had on each occasion penetrated to the breakfast parlour. He described it as an apartment of the most sumptuous nature, and said that he had drunk brown East India sherry there, of a quality so precious as to make a man wink. We had an adjourned cause in the consistory that day, about excommunicating a baker who had been objecting in a vestry to a paving rate, and as the evidence was just twice the length of Robinson Crusoe, according to a calculation I made, it was rather late in the day before we finished. However, we got him excommunicated for 6 weeks and sentenced in no end of costs, and then the baker's proctor and the judge and the advocates on both sides, who were all nearly related, went out of town together, and Mr. Spenlow and I drove away in the phaeton. The phaeton was a very handsome affair. The horses arched their necks and lifted up their legs as if they knew they belonged to Doctors' Commons. There was a good deal of competition in the Commons on all points of display, and it turned out some very choice equipages then. Though I always have considered, and always shall consider, that in my time the great article of competition there was starch, which I think was worn among the proctors to as great an extent as it is in the nature of man to bear. We were very pleasant going down, and Mr. Spenlow gave me some hints in reference to my profession. He said it was the genteelest profession in the world, and must on no account be confounded with the profession of a solicitor, being quite another sort of thing, infinitely more exclusive, less mechanical, and more profitable. We took things much more easily in the Commons than they could be taken anywhere else, he observed, and that set us, as a privileged class, apart. He said it was impossible to conceal the disagreeable fact that we were chiefly employed by solicitors, but he gave me to understand that they were an inferior race of men, universally looked down upon by all proctors of any pretensions. I asked Mr. Spenlow what he considered the best sort of professional business. He replied that a good case of a disputed will, where there was a neat little estate of £30,000 or £40,000, was perhaps the best of all. In such a case, he said, not only were there very pretty pickings in the way of arguments at every stage of the proceedings, and mountains upon mountains of evidence on interrogatory and counter-interrogatory, to say nothing of an appeal lying first to the delegates and then to the lords, but the costs being pretty sure to come out of the estate at last, both sides went at it in a lively and spirited manner, and expense was no consideration. Then he launched into a general eulogium on the Commons. What was to be particularly admired, he said, in the Commons was its compactness. It was the most conveniently organised place in the world. It was the complete idea of snugness. It lay in a nutshell. For example, you brought a divorce case or a restitution case into the consistory. Very good. You tried it in the consistory. You made a quiet little round game of it among a family group, and you played it out at leisure. Suppose you were not satisfied with the consistory, what did you do then? Why, you went into the Arches. What was the Arches? The same court, in the same room, with the same bar and the same practitioners, but another judge. For there, the consistory judge could plead any court day as an advocate. Well, you played your round game out again. Still, you were not satisfied. Very good. What did you do then? Why, you went to the delegates. Who were the delegates? Why, the ecclesiastical delegates were the advocates without any business who had looked on at the round game when it was playing in both courts and had seen the cards shuffled and cut and played and had talked to all the players about it and now came fresh as judges to settle the matter to the satisfaction of everybody. Discontented people might talk of corruption in the Commons, closeness in the Commons, and the necessity of reforming the Commons, said Mr. Spenlow solemnly in conclusion. But when the price of wheat per bushel had been highest, the Commons had been busiest, and a man might lay his hand upon his heart and say this to the whole world, touch the Commons, and down comes the country. I listened to all this with attention, and though I must say I had my doubts whether the country was quite as much obliged to the Commons as Mr. Spenlow made out, I respectfully deferred to his opinion. That about the price of wheat per bushel, I modestly felt, was too much for my strength and quite settled the question. I have never to this hour got the better of that bushel of wheat. It has reappeared to annihilate me all through my life in connection with all kinds of subjects. I don't know now exactly what it has to do with me, or what right it has to crush me on an infinite variety of occasions, but whenever I see my old friend the bushel brought in by the head and shoulders, as he always is, I observe, I give up a subject for lost. This is a digression. I was not the man to touch the Commons and bring down the country. I submissively expressed by my silence my acquiescence in all I'd heard from my superior in years and knowledge, and we talked about the stranger and the drama, and the pair of horses, until we came to Mr. Spenlow's gate. There was a lovely garden to Mr. Spenlow's house, and though that was not the best time of the year for seeing a garden, it was so beautifully kept that I was quite enchanted. There was a charming lawn, there were clusters of trees, and there were perspective walks that I could just distinguish in the dark, arched over with trellis work, on which shrubs and flowers grew in the growing season. Here, Miss Spenlow walks by herself, I thought. Dear me. We went into the house, which was cheerfully lighted up, and into a hall, where there were all sorts of hats, caps, greatcoats, plaids, gloves, whips, and walking sticks. Where is Miss Dora? Said Mr. Spenlow to the servant. Dora, I thought. What a beautiful name. We turned into a room near at hand. I think it was the identical breakfast room, made memorable by the brown East India sherry. And I heard a voice say, Mr. Copperfield, my daughter Dora, and my daughter Dora's confidential friend. It was, no doubt, Mr. Spenlow's voice. But I didn't know it, and I didn't care whose it was. All was over in a moment. I had fulfilled my destiny. I was a captive and a slave. I loved Dora Spenlow to distraction. She was more than human to me. She was a fairy, a sylph. I don't know what she was. Anything that no one ever saw and everything that everybody ever wanted. I was swallowed up in an abyss of love in an instant. There was no pausing on the brink, no looking down or looking back. I was gone, headlong, before I had sense to say a word to her. I, observed a well-remembered voice when I bowed and murmured something, have seen Mr. Copperfield before. The speaker was not Dora. No, the confidential friend, Miss Murdstone. I don't think I was much astonished. To the best of my judgment, no capacity of astonishment was left in me. There was nothing worth mentioning in the material world but Dora Spenlow to be astonished about. I said, "How do you do, Miss Murdstone? I hope you're well." She answered, "Very well." I said, "How is Mr. Murdstone?" She replied, "My brother is robust. I am obliged to you." Mr. Spenlow, who I suppose had been surprised to see us recognise each other, then put in his word. "I'm glad to find," he said, "Copperfield, that you and Miss Murdstone are already acquainted." "Mr. Copperfield and myself," said Miss Murdstone with severe composure, "are connections. We were once slightly acquainted. It was in his childish days. Circumstances have separated us since. I should not have known him." I replied that I should have known her anywhere, which was true enough. "Miss Murdstone has had the goodness," said Mr. Spenlow to me, "to accept the office, if I may so describe it, of my daughter Dora's confidential friend. My daughter Dora having unhappily no mother, Miss Murdstone is obliging enough to become her companion and protector." A passing thought occurred to me that Miss Murdstone, like the pocket instrument called a life preserver, was not so much designed for purposes of protection as of assault. But as I had none but passing thoughts for any subject save Dora, I glanced at her directly afterwards and was thinking that I saw, in her prettily pettish manner, that she wasn't very much inclined to be particularly confidential to her companion and protector, when a bell rang, which Mr. Spenlow said was the first dinner bell, and so carried me off to dress. The idea of dressing oneself, or doing anything in the way of action in that state of love, was a little too ridiculous. I could only sit down before my fire, biting the key of my carpet bag, and think of the captivating, girlish, bright-eyed, lovely Dora. What a form she had, what a face she had, what a graceful, variable, enchanting manner. The bell rang again so soon that I made a mere scramble of my dressing, instead of the careful operation I could have wished under the circumstances, and went downstairs. There was some company. Dora was talking to an old gentleman with a grey head. Grey as he was, and a great-grandfather into the bargain, for he said so, I was madly jealous of him. What a state of mind I was in. I was jealous of everybody. I couldn't bear the idea of anybody knowing Mr. Spenlow better than I did. It was torturing to me to hear them talk of occurrences in which I had had no share. When a most amiable person with a highly polished bald head asked me across the dinner table if that were the first occasion of my seeing the grounds, I could have done anything to him that was savage and revengeful. I don't remember who was there except Dora. I have not the least idea what we had for dinner besides Dora. My impression is that I dined off Dora entirely and sent away half a dozen plates untouched. I sat next to her. I talked to her. She had the most delightful little voice, the gayest little laugh, the pleasantest and most fascinating little ways that ever led a lost youth into hopeless slavery. She was rather diminutive altogether. So much the more precious, I thought. When she went out of the room with Miss Murdstone, no other ladies were of the party, I fell into a reverie, only disturbed by the cruel apprehension that Miss Murdstone would disparage me to her. The amiable creature with the polished head told me a long story which I think was about gardening. I think I heard him say, "My gardener," several times. I seemed to pay the deepest attention to him, but I was wandering in a Garden of Eden all the while with Dora. My apprehensions of being disparaged to the object of my engrossing affection were revived when we went into the drawing-room by the grim and distant aspect of Miss Murdstone, but I was relieved of them in an unexpected manner. "David Copperfield," said